Hal was concentrating on reloading, and when he looked up again, he saw that some of the men in the water had reached the gull and were climbing the rope ladders to the deck. The Buzzard had at last got his pumps working. 20 men were bobbing up and down like monks at prayer as they threw their weight on the handles, and white jets of water were spurting from the nozzles of the canvas hoses, aimed at the base of the flames, which were now spreading over the gull's stern. Hal's next shot shattered the wooden rail on the gull's larboard side, and went on to sweep through the gang serving the bow pump. 4 were snatched away, as though by an invisible set of claws, their blood splattering the others beside them on the handles. The jet of water from the hose shriveled away.
"More men here!"
Cumbrey's voice resounded across the lagoon, as he sent others to take the places of the dead. At once the jet of water was revived, but it made little impression on the leaping flames that now engulfed the gull's stern. Big Daniel reached the shore, and dropped the 2 men he had rescued on the sand. He ran up into the trees, and Hal shouted, "Take command of one of the guns, load with grape, and aim at her decks. Keep them from fighting the fire." Big Daniel grinned at Hal with black teeth and knuckled his forehead. "We'll play his lordship a pretty tune to dance to," he promised. The crew of the Resolution, who had been demoralized by the gull's sneak attack, now began to take heart again at the swing in fortunes. 1 or 2 emerged from where they had been skulking in the forest. Then, as the fire started to crash from the beach batteries and thump into the gull's hull, the others grew bold and rushed back to serve the guns. Soon a sheet of flame and smoke was tearing out of the trees across the water. Flames had reached the gull's mizzen yards and were taking hold in the furled sails. Hal saw the Buzzard striding through the smoke, lit by the flames of his burning ship, an axe in his hand. He stood over the anchor rope where it was drawn tightly through its fairlead, and with one gigantic swing he cut it free. Immediately the ship began to drift across the wind. He raised his head and bellowed an order to his seamen, who were clambering up the shrouds. They shook out the mainsail, and the ship responded quickly. As she caught the rising breeze, the flames poured outwards, and the firefighters were able to run forward and direct the water from the hoses onto the base of the fire. She towed the 2 fireships for a short distance, but when the lines that secured them burned through, the gull left them as she headed slowly down the channel. Along the beach, the culverins continued to pour salvo after salvo into her, but as she drew out of range, the battery fell silent. Still streaming smoke and orange flame behind her, the gull headed for the open sea. Then, as she entered the channel between the heads and looked to have sailed clear away, the batteries hidden in the cliffs opened up on her. Gunsmoke billowed out from among the grey rocks, and cannonballs kicked up spouts of foam along the gull's waterline or punched holes in her sails. Painfully she ran the gauntlet, and at last left the smoking batteries out of range. "Mr. Courtney!" Sir Francis shouted at Hal. Even in the heat of the battle he had used the formal address. "Take a boat and cross to the heads. Keep the gull under observation." Hal and Abberley reached the far side of the bay and climbed up to the high ground on top of the heads. The gull was already a mile offshore, reaching across the wind with sails set on her 2 forward masts. Wisps of dark grey smoke trailed from her stern, and Hal could see that her mizzen sails and her spanker were blackened and still smouldering. Her decks seethed with the tiny figures of her crew as they snuffed out the last of the fire and laboured to get the ship under full control and sailing handily again. "We have given his lordship a lesson he'll long remember," Hal exulted. "I doubt we'll be having any more trouble from him for a while."
The wounded lion is the most dangerous," Abberley grunted. "We have blunted his teeth, but he still has his claws."
When Hal stepped out of the boat onto the beach below the encampment, he found that his father already had a gang of men at work, repairing the damage to the battery culverins along the shore. They were building up the parapets and levelling the 2 guns that had been shot off their mountings by the gull's broadsides. Where she lay careened on the beach, the Resolution had been hit by shot. The gull's fire had knocked great raw wounds in the timbers. Grape shot had peppered her sides, but had not penetrated her stout planks. The carpenter and his mates were already at work, cutting out the damaged sections and checking the frames beneath them, preparatory to replacing them with new oak planking from the ship's stores. The pitch cauldrons were bubbling and smoking over the coals, and the rasping of saws and soughing of planes resounded through the camp. Hal found his father further back among the trees, where the wounded had been laid out under a makeshift canvas shelter. He counted 17, and at a glance could tell that at least 3 men were unlikely to see tomorrow's dawn. Already the aura of death hung over them. Ned Tyler doubled as the ship's surgeon. He'd been trained for the role in the rough empirical school of the gun deck, and he wielded his instruments with the same rude abandon as the carpenters working on the Resolution's punctured hull. Hal saw that he was performing an amputation. One of the topmastmen had taken a blast of grape in his leg, just below the knee, and the limb hung by a tatter of flesh and exposed stringy white sinew, from which protruded sharp white splinters of the shin bone. Two of Ned's mates were trying to hold down the patient on a sheet of blood-soaked canvas as he bucked and writhed. They had thrust a double layer of leather belt between his teeth. The sailor bit down so hard upon it that the sinews in his neck stood out like hempen ropes. His eyes started out of his straining crimson face, and his lips were drawn back in a terrifying rictus. Hal saw one of his rotten black teeth explode under the pressure of his bite. He turned his eyes away and began his report to Sir Francis. "The gal was heading west the last I saw of her. The Buzzard seems to have a fire in hand, although she's still making a cloud of smoke." He was interrupted by screams as Ned laid aside his knife and took up the saw to trim off the shattered bone. Then, abruptly, the man lapsed into silence and slumped back in the grip of the men who held him. Ned stepped back and shook his head. "Our poor bastard's taken shore leave. Bring one of the others." He wiped the sweat and smoke from his face with a blood-caked hand and left a red smear down his cheek. Although Hal's stomach heaved, he kept his voice level as he went on with his report. Cumbrae was cracking on all the sail the gull would carry. He was determined not to show weakness in front of his men and his father, but his voice trailed off as near at hand Ned started to pluck a massive wood splinter from another seaman's back. Hal could not drag away his eyes. Ned's 2 brawny assistants straddled the patient's body and held him down, while he got a grip on the protruding end of the splinter with a pair of blacksmith's tongs. He placed 1 foot on the man's back to give himself purchase, and leaned back with all his weight. The raw splinter was as thick as his thumb, barbed like an arrowhead, and relinquished its grip in the living flesh only with the greatest reluctance. The man's screams rang through the forest. At that moment, Governor Van der Velde came waddling towards them through the trees. His wife was on his arm, weeping pitifully and barely able to support her own weight. Zelda followed her closely, attempting to thrust a green bottle of smelling salts under her mistress's nose.
"Captain Courtney," Van der Velde said, "I must protest in the strongest possible terms. You have placed us in the most dire danger. A ball passed through the roof of my abode. I might have been killed."
He mopped at his streaming jowls with his neckcloth.
At that moment, the wretch who had been receiving Ned's ministrations let out a piercing shriek as one of the assistants poured hot pitch to staunch the bleeding into the deep wound in his back.
"You must keep these oafs of yours quiet," Van der Velde waved disparagingly towards the severely wounded seaman. "Their barnyard bleatings are frightening and offending my wife."
With a last groan, the patient sagged back limply into silence, killed by Ned's kindness. Sir Francis's expression was grim as he lifted his hat to Katinka.
"Mefro, you cannot doubt our consideration for your sensibilities. It seems that the rude fellow prefers to die rather than offend you further."
His expression was hard and unkind as he went on.
"Instead of caterwauling and indulging in the vapours, perhaps you might like to assist Master Ned with his work of tending the wounded."
Van der Velde drew himself to his full height at the suggestion and glared at him.
"Mynheer, you insult my wife. How dare you suggest that she might act the servant to these coarse peasants?"
"I apologize to your lady.
But I suggest that if she is to serve no other purpose here other than beautifying the landscape, you take her back to her hut and keep her there. There will almost certainly be further unpleasant sights and sounds to test her forbearance. Sir Francis nodded at Howell to follow him, and turned his back on the governor. Side by side, he and his son strode towards the beach, past where the sailmakers were stitching the dead into their canvas shrouds, and a gang was already digging their graves. In such heat they must be buried the same day. Howell counted the canvas-covered bundles. "Only 12 are ours," his father told him. "The other 7 are from the Gull, washed up on the beach. We have taken 8 prisoners, too. I'm going to deal with them now." The captives were under guard on the beach, sitting in a line with their hands clasped behind their heads. As they came up to them, Sir Francis said loudly enough for all to hear, "Mr. Courtney, have your men set 8 nooses from that tree?" He pointed to the outspreading branches of a huge wild fig. "We will hang some new fruit from them." He gave a chuckle so macabre that Howell was startled. The 8 sent up a wail of protest. "Oh, don't hang us, sir. It were his lordship's orders. We only did as we was bade." Sir Francis ignored them. "Get those ropes hung up, Mr. Courtney." For a moment longer, Howell hesitated. He was appalled at the prospect of having to carry out such a cold-blooded execution. But then he saw his father's expression and hurried to obey. In short order, ropes were thrown over the stout branches, and the nooses were knotted at the hanging ends. A team of the Resolution sailors stood ready to heave their victims aloft. One at a time, the 8 prisoners from the Gull were dragged to a rope's end, their hands bound behind their backs, their heads thrust through the waiting nooses. At his father's orders, Howell went down the line and adjusted the knots under each victim's ears. Then he turned back to face his father, pale-faced and sick to the stomach. He touched his forehead. "Ready to proceed with the execution, sir?" Sir Francis's face was turned away from the condemned men, and he spoke softly from the corner of his mouth. "Plead for their lives." "Sir?" Howell looked bewildered.
"Damn you," Sir Francis's voice cracked. "Beg me to spare them."
"Beg your pardon, sir, but will you not spare these men?" Howell said loudly.
"Ah, the blackguards deserve nothing but the rope's end," Sir Francis snarled. "I want to see them dance a jig to the devil."
"Well, they were only carrying out the orders of their captain," Howell warmed to the role of advocate. "Will you not give them a chance?" The noosed heads of the 8 men swung back and forth as they followed the argument. Their expressions were abject, but their eyes held a faint glimmer of hope. Sir Francis fingered his chin.
"Oh, I don't know."
His face was still ferocious.
"What would we do with them? Turn them loose into the wilderness to serve as fodder for wild beasts and cannibals? It would be more merciful to string them up."
"You could swear them in as crew to replace the men we have lost," Howell pleaded. Sir Francis looked still more dubious.
"They would not take an oath of allegiance, would they?"
He glared at the condemned men, who, had not the nooses restrained them, might have fallen to their knees.
"We will serve you, truly, sir. The young gentleman is right. You will not find better men nor more loyal than us."
"Bring my Bible from my hut," Sir Francis growled, and the 8 seamen took their oath of service with the nooses around their necks. Big Daniel freed them and led them away, and Sir Francis watched them go with satisfaction.
8 prime specimens to replace some of our losses," he murmured. "We'll need every hand we can find if we are to have the Resolution ready for sea before the end of this month."
He glanced across the lagoon at the entrance between the headlands. "Only the good Lord knows who our next visitors might be, if we linger here." He turned back to Howell. "That leaves only the drunken sots who lapped up the buzzard's rum.
Do you fancy another flogging, Howell?"
"Is this the time to render half our crew useless with the cat, father? If the buzzard returns before we are fit for sea, then they'll fight no better with half the meat stripped off their backs."
"So you say let them go scot-free?" Sir Francis asked coldly, his face close to Howell's.
"Why not find them their share of the spoils from the Standfastigate?" and divide it among the others who fought sober. Sir Francis stared at him a moment longer, then smiled grimly.
The judgment of Solomon. Their purses will give them more pain than their backs,
and it will add a guilder or three to our own share of the prize.